Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation Committee for this Tuesday, February 21st. And for those of you tuning in, we're having an interesting conversation about different forms of sledding. But we'll sled through this agenda as quickly as possible. Members, our first item of business is the approval of the meeting minutes. Meeting minutes, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes of, I believe, February 16th.
The minutes of February 16th are moved. Is there discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So, members, we have several, four bills on the agenda today. And our first bill is House File 1305, Representative Petersburg. Representative Petersburg, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would. I would move House File 1305.
Great. And that will be going to the General Register, I believe. Ways and Means, sorry. Ways and Means.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that catches us up to most of the states around us, in which it says that if you have a qualified and a still valid driver's license from another state, when you apply for a Minnesota driver's license, you don't need to take the written test over again. This is something that has occurred for quite a while, and it's time for us to kind of get caught up to the rest of the country. If people are driving through our state from other states as well, and they don't have to take written tests when they get to the border, and the fact is that almost all the bills that, laws that we have in regards to traffic are the same in other states. It's not necessary for us to retest that. And it will say not only be beneficial to the drivers, but it's will save some time at driver's license bureaus and so forth. And so, Mr. Chair, that is the bill. We are just simply excluding the requirement that those with a valid driver's license from out of state are required to take the written test.
Thank you for presenting the bill. Does the committee, any committee members have any questions? Any discussion? Okay. Well, with that, Representative Petersburg, maybe you have the record at least for this
year. Thank you.
For a quick bill. Any closing comments?
Just thank you for your support. I ask for a green vote, and I will renew my motion to re-refer this to Ways and Means.
So House File 1305 is the motion is to re-refer the bill to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. This is kind of, I think, how the entire month of March is going to go. So, no, just joking. Okay, Representative Senator Mura, you are up next with House File 1921.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Thank you, committee members. I am happy to be here today presenting House File 1921. This is a bill that was brought
to us. We'll just move the bill first.
Oh, sorry.
And I believe House File 1921, we will recommend that it be referred to the General Register. So I'll move that and proceed with your testimony.
So House File 1921 was brought to us by the Department of Public Safety. It is a technical change. It is so typically when a peace officer in the regular course of duty is investigating an accident that happened, they generally need to report that within 10 days of the accident. And this is asking that for when there is a fatality in the accident, that the reporting agency notifies the commissioner within 48 hours. This will allow that we have more fast data about fatalities, accidents, that will make us all safer. I do have Mike Hansen, Office of Traffic Safety Director, here with me today. And with that, I would yield to him to explain further about this bill and what it would do. Thank you.
Fantastic. Mr. Hansen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Mike Hansen. I have the privilege of serving as the director for the Department of Public Safety's Office of Traffic Safety. And it's good to be in front of your committee again. And as the representative explained, this is basically a technical correction to the 16909 accident reporting statute. When a fatality crash occurs, roughly half of the time, the death does not occur on scene, and it can occur a day, a week, or even several weeks after the crash occurs. With the implementation of our MnCrash electronic crash reporting system, we get the actual law enforcement-generated report in almost real time. The problem that we run into is if that death takes place after that crash report is submitted, sometimes we have to wait for the medical examiner's report to come in, which can be weeks or even months after the death actually occurs. And so what this does is it really makes the job of our two FARS analysts, and FARS is the Fatal Analysis Reporting System that the federal U.S. DOT requires that we participate in when it comes to reporting fatal crashes. And when it comes to the fatality crash and the FARS system, the state crash report form that law enforcement generates, that's just the beginning. The FARS system itself requires far more information in order to track fatality crashes and their causes so that we can develop the countermeasures to prevent them from happening in the first place. So by being notified of that fatality in what is much closer to real time, than occurs in many cases right now. It allows us to get a head start on that additional investigation that our analysis have to complete. And it also enables us to keep our real-time daily crash reporting statistics accurate and up to date. And it also allows us a little extra time to identify trends that may be developing out there that we can take countermeasures to prevent that trend from continuing. So it's basically, it's just a housekeeping or technical correction to 16909 that will make our crash reporting and our fatality reporting system much more efficient. And with that, sir, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, and we have a question from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question I have is how does a police officer know if the injury sustained are life-threatening or not, to know whether or not the 48 hours starts? Because if somebody's seriously injured but still alive and die 2 days later, how does that impact this particular piece?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, a very good question. And that is a tough situation for law enforcement to be in. We have a metric that they use to determine injury severity, but I can tell you based on my own law enforcement experience, there are people that walk away from crashes that 2 days later will die as a result of injuries that they sustained in that crash. And there are people who you look at them and you would say, there's no way this person is going to make it, and they walk out of the hospital 2 days later. So what the trigger is for this 48-hour or two business day request would be the actual death of a driver or passenger or participant in that particular crash. So as soon as law enforcement is notified by the medical facility that a fatality has occurred, then that would trigger the notification process.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And that would be kind of what I would suggest too, but I don't think this language does that. It says that a peace officer, at the beginning part of it, which has been added on to, who in a regular course of duty investigates an accident that must be reported under this section, shall within 10 days after the accident forward electronic or written report. But then this one says, if the accident results in a fatality, the reporting agency must notify the commissioner of the basic circumstances of the accident within 48 hours. Well, after 48 hours of what? Well, earlier in the section it talks about regular course of investigation, which means most likely during the initial investigation, and we don't have that information better. So it would seem to me that there should be some clarification that within 48 hours after notification of the fatality or something of that nature to actually clear it up. And that's just food for thought. I mean, you guys do what you want to, but that's something I think should be made clearer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Did you have any additional thoughts or comments, Mr. Hansen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, happy to work on any clarifying language that you think would help to make this read a little bit clearer. Again, what we're just trying to do is this, the notification that we're seeking right now is not a replacement for the law enforcement crash report, the one that is required to be filed within 10 days. This is going to be simply a very short electronic communication that the law enforcement agency would communicate to our office that would allow us to begin tracking that particular crash.
Okay. Any further discussion? Yes, Representative Brandt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. First is, what type of data are you looking for? I mean, what are we looking for? Names? Are we looking for what? Give me some information.
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair and members, just a very basic information. We'll already have the names and some of that basic information based on the crash report that would be submitted, but we're just looking for a very basic summary of the type of crash that it was, a runoff the road, single vehicle, occupant ejected, a head-on collision or a T-bone or something like that. Basically the date, time, the location, and the number of fatalities, and then maybe a basic summary of what law enforcement feels were the contributing factors to that crash. Again, this will allow us to identify those trends as they begin to emerge and allow us to maybe take some steps to alleviate that.
President Brand, a follow-up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And then my follow-up question is this information going to be public? Will this find its way into newspaper articles, things like that, or will this be kind of more private data, or what is the classification for that data?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brandt, and again, a very good question. And the data that we would be requesting would already be considered public data. It would be an abbreviated version of what would be on the crash report, much of which is already considered public as well.
Thank you. Any further discussion from the committee? Okay. Any final comments, Representative Santamira?
I think this is a small technical correction that can hopefully get us better data that can keep us all safer. But happy to have further conversation members of the committee before this goes to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, that is our motion that House File 1921 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sensenmiller. So we have two more bills on the agenda. Both are from Representative Tadke. Okay, Representative Tadke, welcome. And do you have a motion? Do you want me to move this one
for you? You can, Mr. Chair, because I'm not sure what we're doing first.
So the next bill on the agenda is House File 1327, and I will move that with a recommendation to be referred to the General Register. Representative Tadke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So this is a pretty simple bill. It allows Metro Transit to increase the span and breadth of how they do transit passes. So right now it's all decided in statute as to how transit passes are decided through employers and organizations and those kinds of things, and this opens that up and it's moves that forward. So we've got Met Council here to also help out with explaining exactly what this would do, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Who would like to go first? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dennis Dorchek from Metro Transit. Yeah, this bill is just going to update the previous legislation, which only allows our transit passes to be used on fixed route buses. We want to include other modes of transportation, such as the light rail. Our customers right now have metro passes, our customer-based passes, our employer-based passes, and we want them to be reflected to use on both, both light rail, BRT, fixed route buses.
Thank you. Anyone, any further testimony from the Met Council before we get into any questions? Okay, committee questions or discussion. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers and to Representative Dabke, too. The fiscal note doesn't indicate that there's any cost, but in most cases, when you give a pass or reduced fare for an issue like that, there's usually a little loss in revenue. Are you anticipating any of that? Is there any kind of match that says, well, it'll increase ridership, so then you're not really losing any? Have you done any analysis in regards to that?
Mr. Dworshak or anyone else?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is no additional cost. These are fares that already exist. We're just trying to update the legislation so it reflects the fares that already exist. We're not going to be adding any more fares or any more fare discounted fares or passes that we don't already have.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. So you can just give me a nod. So it sounds like you're already doing this. Now you just need to have it codified into law.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. The question, Representative Petersburg. Okay, any further discussion of House File 1327? Vice Chair Tapke, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you very much, everyone, for participating. Hope this goes forward to the General Register.
With that, Representative Tapke, renews the motion that House File 1327 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. And you're on your way to the General Register, Representative Tapke. One last bill, members, and then we'll have a couple of announcements. Vice Chair Tapke, you can just stay right where you are and present House File 1350, which is the DVS policy bill for this year. And see, House File 1350 will be laid over. Hold on 1 second. All right, we're going to lay this bill out over for possible inclusion in an omnibus policy bill, but if you haven't, so that will be the motion. And then there's an author's amendment labeled A1. So let's take care of that first. Vice Chair Tapke.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The author's amendment is some technical changes to the bill that comes forward that came from the agency, from DVS. And so it would rather just go through everything with Mr. Zhang as we go forward. So if we can put the A1 amendment on, then we'll talk through everything at that point.
Okay. Is there a discussion of the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So we now have House File 1350 as amended before us. Vice Chair Tapke.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So this is the DVS policy bill with a variety of technical changes and other pieces that affect how DVS works. And we have Mr. John from DVS here to walk through the pieces of the bill.
Proceed with your testimony and welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pong Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. And thank you, Vice Chair Tapke, for carrying this bill. I'll quickly walk through the sections of this bill and I will happy to be standby for any questions. So Section 1 makes a correction to 168.1235 that adds the Disabled American Veterans as a congressionally chartered organization. Again, this is something that we already recognize, just making a technical change to reflect that in statute. Section 2 clarifies that DVS will not charge $100 to Gold Star Plate families, another practice that DVS already employs, but a correction to reflect that in Minnesota statute. Section 3 removes some outdated language that refers to the commissioner issuing USDOT numbers. That is no longer a practice. That is only issued by FMCSA, and this is language that we worked with FMCSA on to clarify and remove. Sections 4 and 6 does a couple different things for in terms of our dealer applications. It creates some explicit authority for our DVS to deny applications in which there are intentional or negligent misrepresentations on dealer applications. It also designates at a minimum 4 hours each week that dealers need to be available for inspections. And it also extends the temporary license from 120 to 180, giving dealers a little bit more time to meet the requirements to be certified as a dealer. Section 5 removes some ambiguity, specifically the word customarily around the use of tow trucks, service trucks, or parts vehicle use, and just provides some clarity on when dealer plates should and shouldn't be used. Section 7 removes the requirement for a licensed driver to be included on an application following plate impoundment. We really view this as a redundant action, as drivers need to be licensed in order to operate a vehicle. And so the suggestion is to remove that requirement from the application process of an impound plate or a plate after impoundment. Sections 8 and then following Section 12 provides a provision where applicants can, for driver's license and IDs, can designate that they are the exclusive caretaker for another individual for the purposes of emergency notification. This was designed similarly to the providing emergency information, although this would be the opposite, where the person would be responsible for another and would make it so that a law enforcement could inform others if that person was not able to care for that that person, whether they be a child or a vulnerable adult. Section 9 creates a remote application access for individuals incarcerated in non-DOC custodial facilities, such as a county jail. We use this application right now under what is commonly called the Snowbird application. This just allows incarcerated individuals to access a remote application so that they can renew their credential if it expires during their time of incarceration. Section 10 corrects an error in Real ID statute it makes Minnesota in compliance with federal law. It removes that a Real ID from another state could be used as a evidence of lawful status. And again, that just puts us in compliance with Real ID. Section 11 adds several documents to evidence Minnesota residency for Real ID purposes. And I'll just read through those additions. So it's a health savings account statement, retirement account statement, a student summary report from a high school signed by a principal or designated authority, affidavit of residence for group home, cooperative, or religious order, assisted living or nursing home statement, an internet of cable. Internet or cable as utility bill, excuse me. And lastly, Section 13 repeals two outdated provisions, the first of which is to remove the prohibition of providing motor vehicle data over the phone. This is just some old language that really restricts our ability and our business partners' abilities to serve our customers. Data privacy laws would still apply to motor vehicle data, and we would ensure that all data delivered over the phone would be in compliance with Chapter 13. And it also removes a provision in which applicants can use a name other than their legal name. Right now, there is a provision that allows applicants to use a maiden name in lieu of their middle name, and it is something that just would not work in our modern process. Where they're not using their legal name. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you so much for going through the bill. A lot here to discuss. Representative West, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. And I think this is probably a question for the agency.
So you said Section 9 about the prisoners remote applying for licenses, say it's like the Snowbird application that currently exists. What difference in what the individual has to do between the Snowbird application and the prisoner application? Is it the exact same process, or what are the differences?
Mr. Zong.
Mr. Chair, Representative West, it would be the exact same process. It really expands that eligibility to those beyond that Snowbird eligibility.
Follow-up, Representative West?
And just to confirm, currently law-abiding citizens cannot use a remote option to renew their license?
Mr. Zong.
Mr. Chair, Representative West, currently the law only allows for Snowbird applicants, so those who are not in the state, to renew through this remote process. In our governor's budget proposal, we also do have an online renewal process that we've designed for the use of for all Minnesotans.
Representative West.
Now this would be a question for Representative Tabke. Is there a reason you did not include that in your bill for regular citizens to be able to do this? Because it seems like something that would be pretty convenient, and giving the convenience to prisoners instead of law-abiding citizens seems kind of odd.
Vice Chair Tabke.
Mr. Chair and Representative West, this is DVS's agency bill, and so this is including what they needed for technical changes and repealers and those kinds of things, and so that will come as a separate bill with the governor's bill.
Thank you for that. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to go refer to Section 9 as well, only because I know we spent some time on the floor dealing with felons and driver's license and whether or not you're on parole or not. And the question that I have, because I'm not familiar with all of this stuff, my understanding that is if you're convicted of a felony and you're incarcerated, your driving privileges have been revoked. And so I don't see under the definition of incarceration of incarcerated individual or not, whether or not this applies to those that are felons or not felons. And so can you clarify that distinction there? Because I'm unclear as to what that all means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, our intent is to make this available for anybody whose driver credential is still valid. We're happy to go through the language, or we'll verify the language to make sure that it doesn't include those who are ineligible. And again, these are specifically for individuals who are in a non-DOC facility, such as a county jail.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Petersburg?
I think that would, Mr. Chair and Mr. Jean, too. I think that's appropriate, because I think we need to clarify that so that there isn't a loophole for individuals that are there, because whether you're incarcerated in a jail or in a correctional facility and you have been convicted of a felony, you want to make sure that that is the case, that we don't find ourselves providing for driver's license, etc. So that would be something you want to look into. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Are there any other questions or comments from committee members? Discussion? Okay, any final comments from either the agency or the author?
No, nothing, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for taking this on, Vice Chair Tabke. And I understand there might be some other possible changes or amendments coming. So we're definitely going to lay this bill over. And if members have any other issues or concerns about this bill, we do have a little time for further discussion. But I'm glad, Vice Chair Tabke, you got the ball rolling and on the DVS policy bill. And with that, I will lay over House File 1350 for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair.
Okay, members. Well, that brings us to the end of our agenda in terms of bills. And I just wanted to give folks a preview. In case you didn't get the communication, we will not be meeting Thursday. Because of the weather. And so we're going to have to rejigger things a little bit. So just so folks can prepare. Tuesday, the 28th, we will hear Representative Cagle's bill on the Northern Lights Express. We'll also have a, Tuesday, the 28th, we'll hear the, sorry, I said Thursday, I apologize. Tuesday the 28th, we're going to hear the NLX bill. So Tuesday the 29th, House File 409. And then Thursday we'll continue on with some of these high-priority agency bills and other policy bills so that we can meet our deadline, which is coming up pretty quickly. So Tuesday, NLX, and Thursday, agency bills. And again, if anyone has other items that they want to make sure we address here as we approach both policy and finance deadlines, please let me know, let your lead know, and we will schedule bills as appropriate. So with that, members, we are adjourned, and stay safe and be well, and we'll see you on Tuesday, February 28th.